Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is February the 18th. We're in the Capital City Senate Finance Room. Present today, we have Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk. Senator Olson is excused. For the order of the day, we are going to be taking up the Department of Law. We're taking at ease and then we're going to have the chairman of the subcommittee for the university chair the remainder of the meeting. Senator Giesel is in the audience. Welcome, Senator. Again, we are going to take up the Department of Law on cases, judgments, and settlements. Presenter Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General, please come forward, identify yourself, and any additional colleagues you want. Please identify yourself.
Yes, thank you. Corey Mills, for the record, Deputy Attorney General over the Civil Division at the Department of Law. I do have our Administrative Services Director, Amber LeBlanc, on the line. If you really want to get into numbers, I would recommend talking to her. That is not my strong suit, but hopefully I can give you some background information on kind of three particular subjects I was asked to speak to. The first is the supplemental for $4 million that we're asking for what we call the Jeremiah M case, or you may hear it called ABC, because the plaintiff group that brought the case is called A Better Childhood, ABC. Those are two names that you'll hear it called by. Second thing I'm going to talk about is just the judgments and settlements we currently have in the supplemental part of the appropriations bill for the operating. And lastly, I'm going to give you just a snapshot of where our statehood defense multi-year funding that the legislature has provided us in the past is, and our ask quickly for this year. So getting started, so that second slide there, supplemental request on, like I said, Jeremiah M, JM at the top. This was filed in, I'm going to give a brief snapshot of the case. So it was filed in May of 2022. This is active litigation, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time getting into our current strategy. Fortunately, there's been a lot of states, well, fortunately or unfortunately, there's been a lot of states that have been sued by this particular group, so we do have background information that I can provide. But we were sued in May 2022. It was brought on behalf of 14 children who were or are in the custody of our Office of Children's Services. These plaintiffs are represented, like I said, by a group called A Better Childhood, a New York City nonprofit advocacy organization. And then, of course, they have local counsel in Alaska. They are seeking a class certification. So although there are 14 plaintiffs, they have sought to create what they call a class, which means they would represent, you know, every child who is in a similarly situated situation, basically meaning all foster children. A thing to note about this case, you know, a lot of cases that are brought against the state when it comes to torts or civil rights actions, they're damages cases. So the plaintiff is actually seeking some sort of recompense for injury or something that the state did to that individual, you know, allegedly. This is not a case where the plaintiffs are actually seeking damages for themselves. They are seeking institutional or structural reform of the entire child welfare system in Alaska. How do they get funded then, you may ask? That is through attorney's fees that they receive through these lawsuits. So, for example, in Oregon, A Better Childhood was awarded $10 million for their attorney's fees. That's just one example. There's a number. About a third to a half of the states have been sued either by A Better Childhood at this point, or there's a competitor nonprofit advocacy organization. I can't remember the name of it, but it has also sued. So between those two, you have about half to a third of the states, starting about a decade or so ago. And so some of these states have been in what we call consent decrees for a number of years. So we're able to look back and really see how have these lawsuits gone? What have these states done? We've been able to talk to those states. This is red and blue. This is bipartisan. We actually filed an amicus brief in support of California, who's fighting a similar lawsuit. But bottom line, what we found is The advice we got was don't settle. The settlements you'll enter into end up being very long-lasting. They're not settlement agreements that get you out of court. They're actually settlement agreements that get the court more involved in your child welfare system. So basically what they do is you go to court, you enter a settlement agreement, and then a court actually monitors that settlement agreement until the court feels that you have satisfied what the settlement agreement calls for. So not only is it expensive because it requires a court monitor, I believe Texas is now in for $40 million after 7 years just to pay the court monitor. It also means that you have to do whatever the court's telling you to do. You have to spend the money the court tells you to spend. And we just feel that that's not the best way to run our child welfare system. So we are fighting this. Trial was scheduled for May. I did want to update everyone. We had a status conference Friday, I believe, and that trial has been moved to August. So we're moving from May to August for trial. Still a quick trial, and I think we'll be able to cut off discovery, which is one of the most expensive parts of trial. That discovery will still be closed, but the trial will be moved to August. The request here was $4 million. That was taken into account last year. I believe the legislature appropriated $1 or $1.5 million to the Department of Family and Community Services. Was it $1 million? Okay. $1 million, and all of that money ended up coming basically through the Department of Law to pay for reviewing over 4 million documents in discovery. $1 million was not enough. Discovery was very expensive. I think we're into discovery alone for just $2 million, as I recall. And we just were looking out and estimating what it would cost pre-trial, what it would cost trial, and then what it would cost for an appeal. So that $4 million is kind of an all-in to get us all the way through a final adjudication at an appellate court. And the reason for the supplemental, of course, is because we're already somewhat in the hole for this year because it has been so expensive. We had planned on trial in May, now it's August, but that's why we asked for the 3 year, because you never know how these things go and how long they take. So that $4 million would get us through, and we think we can complete this whole process within 3 years. So with that, I'll ask for any questions on that particular case.
Any questions?
Okay. I will move on to the third slide. This is our judgments and settlements for this year. So again, what I just talked about is active litigation. I'm moving into judgments and settlements. And although I know the committee is very aware of this, just for any member of the public who may not know what this is, within the budget every year, there is a provision that pays for various judgments or settlements that resulted from either pre-litigation or litigation. And these are amounts that weren't anticipated within the operating budget, right? Because we don't know how much is going to come out. So these are the cases where the operating budgets were unable to pay for these expenses, right? And they come through the Department of Law because we do the litigation. So we had four this year. I know the supplemental also will be added to potentially as we go forward, so there may be others added, but at this point we have four. I'm going to talk about the first three fairly quickly. They're all attorney's fees, so they were judgments received for attorney's fees that we have to pay what they call the prevailing party, which in this case was not the state. We have Sargent versus the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. This was an unemployment case, and this was, in the end, we settled this, and we settled on the amount of $50,000 to pay the attorney's fees. Part of the settlement was also some structural changes to notice to improve the unemployment benefit system. We thought this was a better way to go than spending a bunch of money on trial. The SEAC versus DNR, so SEAC is the Southeast Alaska Conservation Commission. Oh, I can never remember that last name. Thank you. And I know we don't like, I try not to do acronyms. Against the Department of Natural Resources. This had to do with public notice. This went all the way up to the Alaska Supreme Court, came back down, and the state, it really helped, the case law from the Supreme Court helped refine when a land conveyance amounts to a disposal of interest in a state, in state land. So this involved the Department of Natural Resources actually conveying land to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Alaska Supreme Court determined it was a disposal, which meant that certain public notice under the Constitution is required. So when it came back, the prevailing party was SEAC, this organization, and so this is the amount of attorney's fees that was awarded to them, around $68,000. The last case is Donkel versus the Department of Natural Resources. This had to do with the release of certain well log information, and basically it was a dispute over whether it was confidential or not, whether it had to be disclosed. The court determined that it did have to be disclosed, and so we had to pay Rule 82 fees. That issue is still on appeal as to whether we have to pay full fees. So part of this case is still continuing, but we know we're going to have to pay this amount of fees, and we have a judgment for it. So that's why this amount is in there, $12,000. But there is an appeal as to whether we have to pay more of those fees, and that determination is whether Mr. Donkel is a constitutional litigant. So that's the issue before the Supreme Court. So those are the three that I can run through fairly quickly. Like I said, all attorney's fees and costs. The last one, Lane, I did discuss with this committee earlier. I regret that I don't think I did a very good job of painting the full picture of the case, as the amount is fairly high. So in your in the bill, I think it's to pay $2.6 million approximately. So a little bit of background on this case to understand why the amount. It is a constructive termination case. So basically this employee resigned, but they said, we really didn't resign. You pushed us out. So that was the case. It's really a wrongful termination case and retaliation. The reason for the amounts in this case is it involved an Office of Children's Services worker. There's an Alaska Supreme Court case that you can read that gives the full background and the fact findings of the court. But ultimately, this worker was treated badly by a client of the Office of Children's Services, by some of the parties that are involved in these disputes, and the supervisor didn't do anything to assist this employee. That's what was found by the Alaska Supreme Court. And ultimately, through that, they had not only, injuries, so they had physical injuries, they also had mental injuries. Those went to the Workers' Compensation Board. Meanwhile, this employee resigned because they didn't feel like they could do anything, and they felt like they were pushed out of work. A jury awarded damages to the employee and found that the state had done a wrongful termination in this case. The problem was that they didn't calculate the damages correctly. So that, when we went up to the Alaska Supreme Court, the Alaska Supreme Court said, you're correct, the state was wrong, but you didn't quite do the damages correctly. So a certain amount, the court said, yeah, that's good, but there was an amount that could have doubled for the workers' compensation. So basically the Supreme Court said, you can't double dip. You can't double dip into workers' comp and get damages for the same thing. So the court sent it back down, the Supreme Court sent it back down to determine what is that amount? How does that work? What would be the double dipping? Instead of going through another trial on that issue, we ended up settling both the workers' compensation issue and the damages for the trial in one settlement. So we were able to mediate and not go back through trial. That's the amount you see here. The reason it's so high is it has to go back to 2020 when this started accruing, basically when the jury had originally come out with their determination. So you have to go back in interest all the way to that point in time. So that's why we go from the $1.8 million, which we mediated in settlement, all the way up to the $2.6 million, which is what is actually owed because of the 4-5 years of interest that have occurred at this point. So I hope I made that clear. It's a confusing case, a lot of different facts. The workers' compensation was settled, but that's paid for through workers' comp. So this does not include that amount.
So I have these three civil cases here. Can you get your office get us information on all civil cases for the last 5 years, what has been settled, settled in judgments, and the cases that you've won. So we need to take a look at, evaluate how this department is performing.
So Chair Hoffman, I am happy to look at what we can provide. We do not filter data within our database through settlement or prevailing. We can pull all of the cases we've had. So we'll look at exactly how we can provide what is needed. I think we can provide overall pictures. It might be hard to get really granular, if that makes sense. But I'll provide what I can
so
within
I think
our system.
The people of Alaska need to see, evaluate what, and the legislature, how the Department of Law has been performing on cases such as this and other cases that we've had. I think it's very important when we're in crunch times on finances for the state of Alaska, and we need to know that everyone is performing at the best possible level for the people of Alaska.
Chair Hoffman, no, I think that's valid, and I'm also happy to provide, every year we provide what was collected in cases, so I can go back and find that general information, and then how much at least through our judgments and settlements within the bills, we can definitely do that. And then so we have on average about 5,000 cases active within any given year. So I just want to give a volume to give a picture as to why it might be hard to get specifics, but I think it's very worthwhile for the legislature to understand what we bring to the table and how we do that. And so we will provide whatever we can.
Thank you, Ms. Mills. Senator
Thiel. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Mills, just a little more recently, what is the baseline amount, because these are supplementals, what is the baseline amount in the Department of Law's budget for these judgments and settlements?
Through the Chair, Senator Keel, we don't have a baseline. So if a settlement, we don't have any money to pay judgments and settlements. It may come out of another department's because most of our work is billing other departments. So if they have money within their operating budget, we determine whether they can afford to pay the judgment or settlement, and then whether it should come through the judgments and settlements within the appropriation bill. We don't have a baseline for that.
Senator Keel.
So then these would not be all the judgments and settlements the state has paid for the current fiscal year. These would just be the ones from departments that couldn't scrounge up the cash.
Through the chair, correct.
Okay, so Thank you,
Senator
Chairman.
Keel.
I'll look for your data request.
Thank you.
Any other questions on this one?
No. Please proceed.
Okay. So, statehood defense, a topic that I've been in front of you talking about before. Just wanted to give, because I know we're kind of always asked, how are you doing on this? And we've been trying to be a little bit better about tracking it. This just gives, I think, seven different cases on this slide that we have found success in. A couple of these are still on appeal. I noted those, the ICE SEAL critical habitat, for example, as well as our Federal Highway Administration greenhouse gas performance measures case. Those are both still on appeal. The rest of these have either completed or a large portion of it has completed. Like 40 Mile River, we succeeded in getting about 85% of that disclaimed from the federal government. We're just litigating over 15%. That says remainder going to trial in March. That was another one that happened just, I think, on Friday. That's now been continued until next January or February. So we will see the remainder of the 40 Mile River, and that's a determination about whether the state owns the submerged lands under that last 15% of the river. And of course, the Willow Project is also still on appeal, still waiting for that one, but in the meantime, they're able to move forward, so we're at least happy about that, but still haven't heard back from the Ninth Circuit on that one. So our multi-year statehood defense appropriations. So far, we have been given three main appropriations. One of those was kind of split into two different buckets, as you'll see in the middle. Our first came in fiscal year 2021 for $4 million. That $4 million has been spent. The fiscal year 23 amount that would have gone through this year, the $2 million there has also been spent. We do have $500,000 that was designated for Tongass National Forest litigation. That litigation has been going more slowly than we would have liked, frankly. We spent about $68,000 within that bucket so far, but anticipate those costs to continue to come in. And then the fiscal year 24 to 26, the last appropriation that was provided in this multi-year form, we have spent, as of when this was checked, which I think was the very end of January, $1.7 million. So we still have a little over $3 million left in that multi-year. So last year, on the next page, instead of getting a multi-year appropriation, it was turned into a temporary increment. That means that it lapses at the end of the year. And the intent within the budget and within the hearings was that we would get $500,000 every year for 3 years. Originally, the request was, I think, $2 million a year. That was taken down to $500,000 by the legislature. So that is all we are looking for again this year, is another $500,000 to make sure we can get through the next couple of years with spending the multi-year down as well as this additional $500,000. I think we'll be able to get through fiscal year 26. So we're not asking for any additional funds from what was already at least anticipated from last year. Are there any questions on the statehood defense spending?
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was there an operating amount for statehood defense in FY24?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So I think in fiscal year 24, we just got the multi-year. And then fiscal year 25, we got the $500,000 within the operating temporary increment. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm putting it together here with a $500,000 each in 25, 26, plus the $5 million of multi-year, $6 million for 3 years, and we're past the halfway point. We burned 1.7. Is that the burn rate?
Through the chair, yes. I think that's, yeah.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
Okay. So I think that's the end of my presentation. So unless there are other questions.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. Just curious, do you see, you know, the statehood defense, I guess there's defense, and then there's, you know, maybe even offense, you know, of trying to anticipate things. Do you see any differences in needs considering the change in administration and the differing political landscape that we're in?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, excellent question. That is something we've been grappling with a lot. I think it's a little bit of a crystal ball still right now. I think we'll know a lot more in the next 6 months as the federal agencies get staffed up so we can see where their decision-making lies. However, what I'll tell you, what we're seeing right now is a lot of stays and continuances. So where we thought we were going to trial in March, we're now going to trial in January and February. Where we thought we were going to have oral argument, you know, in the next couple months, it looks like it's out 6 months. I'll give you our kind of guiding principles. One, we don't want to be back here in another 4 years. So if we can get some finality, either through a court decision or other action, we want to do that. Because what we found is we had, you know, one administration, and then another administration, and then a third administration, and now we're on the fourth, and every time it just did this. Ping, pong, ping, pong. And it just, we end up in litigation regardless because you have, it's not just the state in the litigation, right? So that's one of our goals is like, if we're going to do this, let's finish it and not hold this out forever. So one of the things we're asking when we get these requests for, like, can we stay the case because we're still getting staffed up? Okay, but we want to know a date. Sure. What's our date to get this? Either you make a decision on what you're going to do, or we continue the litigation, because we don't want to be back in this position again. So that's one of our kind of guiding principles as we look at these. As we're going forward, we have about 80-plus cases involving the federal government on some sort of either jurisdictional or federal authority issue. Some of them were aligned with the federal government. Some of them were on the opposite side. Not all of those cases are paid for with the multi-year, for example. We have different funding sources. The multi-year was meant to account for the increase. We went from about 40 to 80. What I anticipate in the next 2 years is actually we'll see an increase, because those 80 cases don't go away overnight. And then you're going to get new cases filed against new actions that we may actually like, or actions the state is taking, or aligning with the federal government on. So we may switch sides, but there's still going to be litigation. So if we really want to get things across the finish line, we can't take our foot off the gas pedal, is what we're thinking. Within 2 years, I think we might start seeing a decrease, because at that point, the 80 cases, we will have hopefully worked out where those are at, and then you'll have the new litigation, but it hopefully won't be at the volume that we're seeing right now. So that's, again, a little bit of a crystal ball prediction, just based on what I'm hearing and seeing, both with the federal government as well as, you know, our multi-state partners.
Thank you.
Senator Kaufman, thank you. Any additional questions or comments by members of the committee? I have a general question, I guess. People have come to me and asked, how does the department decide on what cases to take? In the region that I represent is predominantly Alaska Native, 85%. And many of them are concerned about the direction the state of Alaska is taking that directly affect their lives.
So, Chair Hoffman, in terms of, so the cases where the state is sued, we're kind of in a position we have to defend, right?
Or settle
in some cases. When it involves like a statute, we tend to lean towards it's our duty to defend that statute. We believe you passed the laws, we need to defend those laws. So when there are buckets, I guess, is my point. But absolutely, we always evaluate settlement. We're always looking at, is mediation the best way to go? Do we settle it? And then, of course, there's the cases where we're proactive, right? Where we're actually bringing the lawsuit. Those are much less in the case of the state of Alaska. Most of our proactive lawsuits are child in need of aid cases or mental commitments. That's our largest category of cases. When you look at the other cases we bring, it's usually about state sovereignty, you know, state jurisdiction. Where do those lines, you have tribal sovereignty, you have state sovereignty, you have federal sovereignty. And there's lines there that aren't very clear. And so we're always butting up against where are those lines. And there's policy choices in there as well. And I didn't get any votes in the last election. You all got votes. The governor got votes. And so from a policy perspective, we're following, you know, the direction of the administration, because they're the ones who set the policy for the state, and that's who the people elected to do so, just as all of you around this table are. So those are our guiding principles, I'd say, when we're looking at various cases and why or why not. And then it's a resource issue, right? We're always looking at our resources as well.
And 30 years ago, there was issues between the state and the tribes on tribal sovereignty. Where do we stand today for the listening audience on the state recognizing tribal sovereignty?
So, Chair Hoffman, I want to be very clear that tribes are sovereign. That is our opinion. We have an AG opinion on our website stating just that. We think the case law has made that clear. I know there were questions way back when. I think we withdrew the AG opinion that actually challenged that. So tribes are sovereign. The question then comes, what are the bounds of that sovereignty? Just like the state has certain bounds of its sovereignty, the federal government has certain bounds with its sovereignty, tribes also have certain bounds, and we have special laws in Alaska that are unique that we all have to grapple with. So I would say tribes are definitely sovereign. Then the question is how far that sovereignty goes.
And what dialogues has the state of Alaska taken with those tribes to clarify those boundaries? Is that an ongoing process? Is that an annual process? Or is, for the most part, are those blurry lines settled in court?
Chair Hoffman, I think we are striving now to try to settle those more outside of court. I would say it's an area we were lacking in, frankly, for a long time. 2 years ago, I think it's 2 years ago, this body and the other body approved a tribal attorney for the civil division at the Department of Law. We were able to bring that person on, and the criminal division now has one as well. I would say we've made great strides towards opening up dialogue, having discussions about, where can we find common ground, where do we see those lines, and how do we ensure that there are going to be disputes, just like there's going to continue to be disputes with the federal government. I don't care who's in office in D.C. Can we limit those disputes? And where can we work together? And I think we're doing a lot towards that we weren't doing before. And our two tribal liaisons, I put a lot of stock in what they've done and what they've brought to the table. You'll also find that our website now has an entire page devoted to our tribal relations, which is something we've never had before. So I'm actually excited about where we could be in the next few years.
And do we have current litigation with tribes on those boundaries today?
Chair Hoffman, yes, we do. The major cases, of course, are they actually involve suits against the federal government, but it involves tribal interests, and I don't want to diminish that. So we have the Lands Into Trust issue here in Juneau, and we also have the Aklutna issue are the two major ones I can think of off the top of my head.
And the Aklutna issue is tribal gaming?
Chair Hoffman, so it's really about what is Indian country. And if it is Indian country, then absolutely tribal gaming is appropriate. So it's not really about the gaming. It's about the initial land designation. Is it Indian country? Is the question we're trying to get answered.
The, I know that's complicated, and I've met with some of those members, but how can a tribe have their license from the federal government, which is not very, it's very complicated in order to get them. So I think I'd like to have further conversations with the Department of Law regarding this. Are there further questions? Seeing none, we'll stand at ease.
call the Senate Finance Committee meeting back to order as the Subcommittee of the Whole on the University of Alaska budget. It is 9:56 a.m. I'd like to thank our LAO moderator, David Moore, and our secretary, I think Laura Hosey is taking the minutes. We have Mr. Chad Hutchinson with us, the State Director for Government Relations at the university. And I believe, Mr. Hutchinson, online you have, for a limited time, some of the leadership team. Let me ask you to let us know who's online with you, and we'll give you the presentation.
Thank you, Senator Keel. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchinson, State Director of Government Relations for the University of Alaska System. Online today, I have President Pitney, Vice President Michelle Rizik, and our Budget Director, Alicia Kruckenberg.
And we have 20 minutes to hit them with the hardest questions, and then you, right?
Senator Keel, that is correct. President Pitney had a previously scheduled meeting with Congressman Begich, but she's available online to start the presentation.
Okay. President Pitney, if you would put yourself on the record, we have your slides up. Please begin.
Thank you. For the record, Pat Pitney, University of Alaska President. And thank you, Chair Keel and the rest of Senate Finance for the opportunity to discuss our budget. I'm assuming we're on page 2, just the layout. I think everybody's very familiar with the layout of the University of Alaska system. One thing I would like to mention is 2 years ago, our board adopted the roadmap for Empowering Alaska, and in that plan for us, there were three pillars: it's financially responsible and future focused, state and Arctic leadership, and then quality education and reputation. Along with those pillars, there's goals. There's a clear roles and responsibilities between the system office and the universities, and there were 6 strategic priorities, and those 6 strategic priorities include enrollment, in terms of recruitment, retention, and speed to graduation, cost-efficient operations, the moving UAF from its current Tier 2 research level into being recognized as a Tier 1 research university. We put forward a strategy for long-term deferred maintenance, another strategic item was elevating our position as an Arctic leader in the higher education space. So those strategic priorities very much are what guide our our budget request. We move on to page 4. There's a just a breakdown or some highlights on our enrollment. Our enrollment continues to increase. We did have a reporting change this year at UAA, where they moved teacher professional development and the boat safety courses that had previously been in fourth credit mode. They moved those to non-credit mode because they're more consistent with the type of training that is being provided. And that impacted That impacted about 1,500 students, moved them essentially off our for credit reporting. When you normalize for that, we're up in the 5% range. When we take those out, then it's, our enrollment shows flat. But our first-time freshman numbers continue to be in the double digits, and overall enrollment continues to grow modestly. One of the main budget requests that the board has put forward is support for the recruitment, retention, and graduation accelerating our increasing enrollment. More than anything, our financial stability is based on our a strong student body. And although we're seeing increases, we're doubling down to accelerate those increases. We see continued strong increases in our dual enrollment across the system. And our retention is at an all-time high. And we are, again, trying to increase that. But a point of note, the retention for our APS students is nearly 90% freshman to sophomore. And that's incredible. And we're getting close to a 60% graduation on our APS scholars. And so both of those we want to continue to increase. And just a note, thank you for the support on the WAMI program. We're increasing that incoming class from 20 to 30 this year, and that was due to the support of the legislature in that increase. So we're going from 20 to 30. Before I jump into the our budget request, are there any questions, knowing that I have to leave in about 10 minutes?
I don't see questions from the committee. Please proceed.
Great. Okay. So I'm on page 5. So our operating request is a total of $34.5 million in general funds. Of that, $24 million is in our compensation and other fixed costs. And then, as I mentioned, our attention on recruitment, retention, and graduation. The board requested $5 million and anticipates $5 million in additional revenue based on that investment. In the governor's budget, the receipt authority is provided, but the general fund is not. So the compensation and other fixed costs, all but about $100,000 of that is included in the governor's budget. So a much better start this year than we had last year. The other operating request is $5 million for athletics. This is $2.5 million to each Fairbanks athletics program and $2.5 million for the Anchorage athletics program. And the economic growth title there is really should say agriculture. This is a base funding for agriculture. In addition to the base funding for agriculture, there is one-time funding included in the capital budget, in the governor's capital budget. But the program support is not included in the governor's budget at this time. Quickly on the capital budget, first First priority, of course, is our $60 million in deferred maintenance. We did put forward a strategy last year that a bill was introduced in the House that would provide $35 million in annual funding into a major maintenance fund for the university. That if we have $35 million annually where we can count on that consistency in the deferred maintenance fund, we could take the $60 million off the capital budget and focus our capital budget on items unrelated to deferred maintenance. Because right now, I mean, for the 30 plus years that I've been involved with the university budget, the deferred maintenance always takes the top slot in the capital budget, and we rarely get past that deferred maintenance need. But more importantly, it's the consistency of funding. The last time the university received $35 million on an annual basis was in the 2010 to 2015 timeframe. And during that time, we were able to keep our deferred maintenance backlog from growing. And in fact, we were able to bring it down slightly. Now that $35 million state funds would then be augmented with additional university funds. As our debt service declines, we would reallocate that debt service into that funding, and our goal would be to get that annual fund up to $60 million a year, and that is essentially the depreciation level of our facilities on an annual basis. So deferred maintenance still remains our top priority in the capital budget. We have additional capital requests. First on the list is the Seward Marine Center. We have the opportunity to receive an NSF grant for dock improvements in Seward, and this would replace and get rid of some deferred maintenance, the shoreside facilities there. That's an $18 million request. There's funding for mariculture class classroom building, and there's also funding for the Alaska Leaders Archive at about $2.5 million on the Leaders Archive and in a range of four for the mariculture classroom. There's also continued support for the Quasi program in the governor's budget, as well as additional funding for reaching R1. If you recall, it was $17 million put forward by the legislature last year for R1 in a combination of general fund and that was vetoed down to $12.5 million, and there's currently $5 million in the capital budget. I think Ledge Finance would say that the more appropriately put in the operating budget as a multi-year appropriation. We are comfortable in either direction on those funds. There were some questions that I wanted to hit before I have to depart, and then I will let Chad and Alicia go into the specific numbers on the next page. But the questions that I received in advance was about the federal turbulence right now and what impact that would have on the university. The current executive orders are are more disruptive and creating uncertainty. But each of those executive orders has been in often ways put on through the courts, put on hold. There was a couple of days where there was funding was paused, and that the courts turned that on. I don't see tremendous beyond being disruptive. We're not seeing tremendous impact. We have a few programs where the program officers are calling stop the program, but they are, under $100,000 range. An example is a program called Girls on Ice to encourage girls to choose the hard sciences and geology. But for the most part, our research agenda is very aligned with the state needs, but also very aligned with this administration. So I think our current portfolio of federal grants and contracts, which is about 1,500 active grants and contracts with about $200 million a year, there's probably 5% of that that is at risk. Really, it's what is coming forward and how is the federal government going to prioritize continued research. In some ways, I'm happy that we are relatively small. For instance, University of Washington probably has over $1 billion in NIH research. We have in the range of 30 million. So it's more disruptive than it is major impact right now. It's really what is it going to be? What are the research priorities and functions at federal government going to look like in next year, the year after? That is more the concern. I feel very comfortable that our portfolio of research and defense and drones, heavy oil, mining, strategic minerals, mariculture, fisheries aligns quite well with the federal agenda. And so I think we're positioned well if the federal government maintains course with university research.
Thank you, President Pitney. I know that there are some members who have expressed concerns about coordination given the most recent guidance from the U.S. Department of Education with the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. I'm particularly concerned about the Preparing Indigenous Teachers for Alaska Schools program. So please keep the committee up to date on that.
Will do.
Other questions for President Pitney before she has to go? I think she's got a Congress critter to meet. Seeing that, anything further before you hand it over to the team, Madam President?
Nothing further. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hutchinson, I'll let you quarterback your presentation, whether it's you or Ms. Rizik, or go right ahead.
Senator Keel, thank you. For the next slide, let's go to Budget Director Alicia Kruckenberg to explain some of the numbers.
Hello. So my name is Alicia Kruckenberg. I'm the budget director for the University of Alaska. Can you all hear me okay?
You're coming in fine. Please proceed.
Excellent. So, Chad, we on the board versus the governors, or have you moved on to slide 7?
We're on slide 6.
Slide 6, okay. So this just recaps what President Pitney just went over, just in numbers for the operating budget. So as she mentioned, most of our compensation and fixed costs are supported in the bill before you from the governor's office. One thing that will be a little problematic for us is the one-time funding of university receipt authority for our retention, recruitment, and graduation support. So that 4.9 that's supported really needs the state support in order for those programs to generate the increased enrollment that was envisioned by those programs. Moving down, there are some other budget requests on here. And I don't recall, sorry, Chad, I was prepped for the next slide. I don't recall off the top of my head what are in those. Hang on 1 second, sorry about that. So athletics, I believe, is down in that other budget request line, so $5 million for that. And
Budget Director Krugenberg, I can also add, athletics is included at $5 million, and then the agriculture landfill discharge, which we'll talk a little bit more for $400,000 that President Pitney referenced.
Yes, and then down in the budget adjustment. So those are, and we'll get into these a little bit later, but this is really truing up some of our budget authority in some cases that has been not sufficient for many years, and also moving some of our budget authority around to capture it in a more correct place. So specifically, things that were non-federal grants and contracts had been running through our university receipt authority, and OMB indicated that those would be better classified as statutory designated program receipts. So we have a request in there both to move some of our university receipts and increase that SDPR designation for receipt authority to align with where we believe we'll be collecting and expending those funds from.
Director, we're happy to work with you to true up the books. Can you give the committee a sense of how much additional receipt authority you're looking for headroom over and above what you expect to get in, bring in this year?
I want to say there's maybe a bit of a 5% buffer, possibly. We've done our first comprehensive financial review here recently with the board, so we're still trying to dial in some of that information, but there is a little bit of buffer built in. You'll notice in our supplemental, it's a little higher than our FY26 request at the moment because we're still trying to dial in. There's always a concern that our budget gets too inflated, so we're trying to get it as close as possible, but these are big numbers, right, and it's a lot of activity. So.
Okay.
Well, I can give you more specific numbers if you'd like me to follow up with that.
That'll be great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Perfect. If there's no other questions on slide 6, Chad, if you could move me to slide 7.
Alicia, you're on slide 7.
Slide 7, thank you. So I'll direct your attention to the far right side of this chart, and then this is basically showing where we think we're going to increase our earned revenue. So roughly $24 million we believe will be our increase in various types of earned revenue, which will help cover our compensation and fixed cost increases. So, you know, a portion, so we're not asking for all general fund on either of those items. It's roughly 50-50 in aggregate for the request for state appropriation versus general fund, or sorry, state appropriation versus earned revenue. So tuition and fee revenue, we think that's going to go up about 9%. or I'm sorry, 8%, $9 million. And that's a combination of a rate increase and also some enrollment increases that we're finally realizing. The $2 million in other unrestricted funds, that's almost exclusively ICR or indirect cost recovery. So those are basically the overhead that we can earn on federal grants. And so, you know, with some of the stuff going on with federal agencies and talk about possibly reducing that that rate that we're collecting, we'll have to monitor that closely. Because that does pay for, again, the overhead that's associated with doing those grants. Federal receipts, we have $7 million built in for that, or that's roughly a 3.5% increase. And then $6 million in designated and restricted funds, that's mostly our auxiliary. So our auxiliary, we'll get into this a little more later in the ratification information, but our auxiliaries basically post-COVID have run a bit of a deficit, several of them. So at the end of the year, they have to be trued up with other earned revenue. An auxiliary by nature should be self-supporting, but these simply weren't. Either we didn't have enough enrollment to support the operations, or the rates weren't high enough. So we're monitoring those very closely, and those that were in serious deficit have plans that were submitted to the board, or will be discussed, I guess, later this week with the board to get those ships righted again. All right. I don't really have anything else to talk about on this slide, so if there's no questions, we can move on to slide 8. All righty. So on slide 8, I'll direct you to the FY25 budget. And if you go down to the bottom where it says total revenue, you'll notice that our budget is $944 million. And our year-end projections, based on those mid-year reports that I discussed earlier, that leaves us with a delta of roughly $106 million in receipt authority that we need but we don't have. So that's further complicated by the fact that if you go up one line in other, that delta is roughly $124 million. So even if we have extra budget authority, if we don't have it in the right place, we can't spend it. So so this is, you know, just kind of a visual of where those deficits are occurring in the format that you are used to seeing in your state reports. So I don't have anything else to go over on these slides, and if there's no questions, I can hand it back to Chad.
Mr. Hutchinson.
Thank you, Senator Keel. For the record again, my name is Chad Hutchinson, State Director for Government Relations for the University System. So these points will go into more detail about some of the high points that President Pitney talked about when she spoke. This is the compensation increase that we're requesting for this year, and we're grateful to the governor's office for working with us to ensure that that was in his proposed budget. The salary and benefits increase proportionate amount is $5.9 million of state general fund dollars. This is the direct result of the wage increases from our existing collective bargaining agreements, and a wage increase of 2.75% for non-union staff. We have just reached an agreement with United Academics, that's UNAC, which you see up there, and that's a 3-year contract for FY26, FY27, FY28 for 2.75% in FY26, 3% in FY27, and 3.25% in FY28. We've submitted the funding request to OMB. Our hope is that we avoid the timing issues that we had to deal with last year when it came to our grad student union. So we're hoping to get it to everybody with due proper time and give everyone proper notice that was a negotiated agreement that we have. The Board of Regents is going to meet this Thursday and Friday to talk about that union agreement, and the union is giving that a review. And our hope is that goes forward. You see that the expectation is $2.3 million for UGF moving forward. We're still under negotiations with UNAD. That is our adjunct professors. And that contract expires in FY25. Negotiations are going fairly well as of this time, and we're expecting an amount tentatively in $800,000, $700,000expected. So that conversation continues, and once we have that information, we're going to make sure, once that's solidified and is approved by the Board of Regents, we'll make sure that amendment is submitted to Senator Hoffman and his trusty staff. A big portion of the compensation increase that you see there, so that's the $5.9 million of UGF salary and benefits. Healthcare increases $14.2 million. That is the remainder of that $20.1 million. Our insurance has gone up, as it has for many of us throughout Alaska. Primera Blue Shield is our provider. The expected premium costs are up $7 million. The under-recovery, so that's the amount that the healthcare provider does not receive because even though it provides service to the patient, it's the amount that is still owed. The under-recovery is still an issue from our perspective. So the $14.2 million is what you see there. That's bundled with our overall compensation request, and the great news is that Governor Dunleavy has fully funded that moving forward, and so we are grateful for that. On the operating budget, going to the fixed cost increases that was referenced earlier, cybersecurity, information technology, $825,000. For a further breakdown of that to understand what that money is getting, and this is page 3 in the Red Book, the Red Books that we distributed to each of the offices, and we have the digital versions available for folks, too. It's also available online. We have system office contracts that cover our hardware and software for the entire system. So, for example, on our email and our storage, we have contracts with Google and Microsoft, Palo Alto for network firewalls, Blackboard for our learning management systems, and Elucid for our resources planning. And so the software and hardware maintenance is continual, and upgrades continue, and that's what that amount is covering. Again, the predominant amount of the figures that you see up in front of you were funded in the governor's proposed budget. So the second major IT component is our software licensing and our contract increases. It has to do with employee recruitment at UAA, UAS, and UAF to make sure we have the personnel with competitive wages that can work our IT issues throughout those universities. And that's an amount of $500,000 of that $825,000. And then the third component of the cybersecurity and information technology is at UAA. It's personnel related to audio-video specialist at UAA for $125,000. The facilities maintenance and break-fix operating costs, $2 million. This is preventative maintenance from our perspective. I know, Senator Keel, you've had questions in the past about what we're spending on preventative maintenance. The answer is $30 million per year, approximately. So this would add to that amount. That's the wear and tear on the buildings that are happening on a consistent basis. Whenever you're dealing with residents, student housing, et cetera, there's a lot of activity. So that's $2 million that would be added to that overall preventative maintenance per year going forward. Utilities cost increases. This is at UAA and UAF. And of that $1.2 million state general fund, UGF, Chugach filed for a rate increase, and now we're looking at about a 12% increase on what our costs are at UAA. And then UAF has got its own needs that have increased, and this goes across the board, electricity, fuel, water, sewer. They all went up. A lot of it has to do with our rural campuses. There's Fairbanks, but there's also with Bethel, Kotzebue, Nome, just everything has gone up at a pretty significant rate. So that's part of what's being covered there as far as the utility cost increases. Like I said before, it's the great news that the governor has funded that in his proposed budget, and that's something we're thankful for.
Mr. Hutchison, how are the electrical bills in the Southeast?
Senator Keel, UAS in comparison to the electrical bills that we have in the interior and South Central are significantly lower.
Glad to hear it.
Forward planning helped a lot, I think, for the community in many ways as far as that goes. Okay, program requests. Now, this is something that's, that Board of Regents is very passionate about. As President Pitney mentioned before, you saw that we have we still have, in over the course of the entire system, a 1.1% gain in enrollment, but we also can see, I mean, the birth dearth is at the precipice of our doorstep. We see the declining enrollment when it comes to K through 12. President Pitney wants to make sure that we're preparing ourselves for the future. And the great news is the Board of Regents has given this heavy review, the EAB report. So EIB stands for Education Advisory Board. That's what it used to stand for. Now it's just an acronym. EAB is what they call themselves. But they did a report that went to the ad hoc committee with the Board of Regents. That got recommended to the Board of Regents on the whole and will be taken up either Thursday or Friday for confirmation in order to adopt some of the recommendations from the report. And some of the proposed recommendations that are happening thus far, to go in a little bit more detail, so they have a system. So what are you getting for $5 million? They have a system called Navigate 360 that allows for early alerts, counselor engagement when it comes to students trying to make their way through the university system, making sure they're on track, that a freshman becomes a sophomore, becomes a junior, becomes a senior. An awareness program starting at grades 7th and 8th of the Alaska Performance Scholarship, which I think that the more notice, the better, that we can give parents for those young people coming up in-state. I think that there's a wisdom to giving that good review. Multi-model marketing, which is a fancy way of saying that depending on how social media and other technological innovation is reaching young people and their parents, are we doing our very best to embrace that? We're doing a version of that now, but this would be a redoubling of that effort. A common data warehousing so the entire system can understand as the student makes its way through the process that there's a good analysis, and if there's any red flags about missed time frames, that we can have counselors or other advisors to help to make sure that student is on the right path to get through and graduate with other with whatever degree or certificate or whatever they are seeking to achieve. And there's thoughts about a UAS pilot program, which is an out-of-state, in-state matching of tuition. And the goal is to boost UAS in particular, about 500 students, and that's something that will be considered by the Board of Regents, and depending on the success of that program, it may be considered beyond that scope, but the pilot program is going to take place potentially at UAS if the Board of Regents decides to approve that. This also kind of aligns with what else are you getting at for $5 million. We have all the campuses in various different degrees. It is true that that there is a focus on out-of-state and in-state, so I mentioned some of the things that we're doing from the in-state perspective. Out-of-state, the governor has talked to President Pitney about what we can do to help boost the working-age population in Alaska, and $500,000 would go towards recruitment efforts out of UAA for more recruiters, and their expectation is, you know, the return on investment that they're looking at just on a preliminary basis, the analysis that they've given us thus far, is that like 25 out-of-state students at $841 a credit for 24 credits bring in approximately $500,000. So that's just at UAA. At UAF, $600,000 would go towards UAF's enrollment funnel, which has actually been pretty successful thus far. They've already had 2,000 additional applications, and actually the issue that they're having now is a human resource capacity issue. So the expectation with that $600,000 is they would have dedicated recruiters both for international and lower 48, and one of the fertile ground that we've had as far as international goes is India. They have an appetite for academia, and there's and we're just pleased to have that partnership, and we are looking to expand that partnership. UAS is thinking about $190,000, two positions that bolster out-of-state recruitment to targeted areas, with the hope of increasing the overall population of UAS as far as our enrollment student headcount by 5% by FY 2027. So that's the investment they're looking at targeted areas. And I'll just add one more in-state, just as we talk about some of the lists that we're doing with the $5 million with UAS in particular, a dual enrollment coordinator for $125,000 that would be based out of Juneau but would focus on those young people in Sitka and Ketchikan and making sure that they're aware of all the opportunity that that UAS provides and showing up to events and encouraging them as they're younger to get them in our system pipeline moving forward and encourage them about the great benefits and the good things that UAS has to offer, which there are many. So the second item on that list is athletics. And athletics to the Board of Regents is really about marketing and enrollment. And a lot of young people in Alaska, their first taste of the university is going to a basketball game or volleyball or hockey. And one of the issues that happened with athletics when we went through the compact years is that one of the first things cut was athletics, quite frankly. And it's in the process of recovery in many ways. UAF and UAA are different. Their need is different. So it's $5 million. It's $2.5 million UGF for UAF and $2.5 million for UAA. With UAA, they're trying to just stabilize their program. And the key ones that they're looking at are hockey, gymnastics, and skiing. And that's them trying to recover going back to the compact years. And then UAF is on a little bit different plane, and they're more interested in expanding to Division I and the notoriety that would come, particularly in hockey, but it would benefit the entirety of the UAF athletics program, so in basketball, volleyball, et cetera. So that's athletics, and that's some of the reasoning why the Board of Regents felt like it was worthy of consideration, because from their perspective, they consider it's marketing and it's something that helps with future enrollment. And then there's just a lot of constituents that are very passionate about athletics over the years.
Mr. Hutchison, I missed the number for the third university for this vital recruitment tool.
What, say again, Senator Keel, I'm sorry.
I missed the number for the third university in the system for this vital recruitment tool.
I'm sorry, what's the last part?
This vital recruitment tool you talked about, this very important way that Alaskans first encounter the University of Alaska system. You gave the number for two of the universities. What was the third?
Yes, there's only two universities in that athletics request.
Huh.
Yes. So that's deemed by the Board of Regents. So UAF and UAA, yes. So the next category that you see there is the economic growth for Alaska, 375,000. This is something that President Finney talked about before, which is, and this is an interesting one from my perspective. This is diverting waste stream landfills for soil amendments is what you're getting with the food security component of that. That's $200,000, and it would be used to help bolster. I think there's certainly an appetite for agriculture at this point in time in our history, and this is something that they can use the wastewater from landfills to be used as fertilizer, and it's something that we're in the precipice of. It's something that they're pretty encouraged about, and that's what you'd be getting with the $375,000, at least the $200,000 of that amount. And the remainder, the $175,000 that's UGF that you see up there, is UAF field work. And this is an application, a software system that all of our field researchers use when they're out on site. And UAF is certainly that's one of their strengths, is they do a lot of field work on volcanoes and earthquake zones and very remote areas, and this would be a software upgrade to make sure that they're in they have bleeding edge technology when it comes to the regulatory oversight and some of the parameters that they need that are necessary in order to operate out in the field consistently. Any questions about any of that?
Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm going to go back to the athletics, right? And I'm a firm believer in being the best. And as somebody that's went through the athletic system at UAF, I was a player there and, you know, earned my degree through that. But right now, what I want to see, and we've set that, we've made a great example of recruiting Alaska kids and having success at the national level. And right now, we really, it's very hard to do that. If we look at UAF basketball right now, they offer like 5.5 scholarships. You cannot run an Alaska program with 5.5 scholarships. There are many rural kids. There's many urban kids in Alaska that could be part of that program, but we're all about winning, right? So you don't have the time to develop those players into, you know, Division II athletes, right? So you're going to have to focus on out-of-state students. So I believe in, if we're going to fund and want to be the best, we're going to have to fund our programs, because I want more Alaska kids playing, whether it's at UAA or UAF, on those teams with that success, right? And we've proven that model. We've just went way away from it right now. So having that model brings more Alaska students to these programs, which is going to bolster, obviously, I would think, you know, attendance for students to want to be part of that. So I really am a firm believer in being the best, right? And so I do believe we have to fund that a little bit better, because I want to see more success stories from Alaska students, whether it's in whatever sport it's at, UAA or UAF. Thank you.
Mr. Hutchinson, on the recruitment, retention, and support, you talked about investments in recruiting out of state and internationally. And if you could get back to the committee with the plan in terms of how those funds will be split between international, where there are lots and lots of 18-year-olds, and out of state, where there's a declining number of 18-year-olds, to misapply a term, what's the prospectivity?
Yeah, Senator Keel, we will get back to you on that.
Thank you.
So the next slide, really this reaffirms and talks about some of the elements I've already discussed. So this just gives you some time frames that I've spoken about before. So we'll go to the next slide. Legislative discussion points. Again, this will I'll spend a brief amount of time on this because President Pitney covered this. As she mentioned, what is actually HB 236 from Representative Stapp last year about our deferred major maintenance fund in the language section of the operating bill was the vision. We always continue to have those legislative discussions. There's no bill this year, but it's something that we raise as an open question from our perspective. And then one of the things that we're certainly thinking about is, and I touched on it before with our rising insurance costs, is can the economics of pooling with the state work? I know that we're watching HB 29 and SB 5 to just see what the progress is. The university has done an analysis in years past, and the economics did not quite work out for us during that era. But we're always open to the conversation, and as things change, maybe that changes for us in 2025. But there's no predominant legislation that we're pushing per se, but we're certainly watching the conversation as the legislative debate unwinds there. And with that, if there's any more questions, and I know Senator Keel, I believe you might have had some more questions. And just real quickly, maybe we can talk to I want to, the ratification issue that Budget Director Krugenberg talked about. I think it's important for the committee to know, to make sure that we're stating what occurred. And Budget Director Krugenberg, can you talk a little bit about the FY24 ratification?
Yeah, so for the record, Alicia Krugenberg, UA Budget Director. So in FY24, we expended more university receipts than we had budget authority to spend. That being said, we had the revenue, we just didn't have the budget authority to make those expenditures. And it wasn't just one thing. The bottom part of the slide kind of quantifies the main drivers in that. So as I mentioned, the statutory designated program receipts. So an increase of roughly $5.5 million was from corporate and nonprofit grants and contracts. So that that activity required, at the time, university receipt authority. We had a accounting practice change for how we utilized our UA Foundation funds, which brought them onto university books where previously they were not. So that was roughly a $6 million accounting change, plus some of that activity increase, which is what we were hoping for with the accounting change, and that was roughly $2 million. A little bit of a bump up in our land management and natural resources activity, and then the largest by far was the $11.4 million in unrestricted operations. So this was activity that we had indicated in our budget request. Costs were going to were going up. So this is, you know, just where that activity showed up. So the higher cost of our employee benefits and recruiting and retaining employees was part of that, and other just general operations, so utilities and those sort of things. And then, like I was talking earlier, too, the deficit in our auxiliaries and recharges, at the end of the year, we had to balance them. They couldn't remain deficit at the end of the year. We had to balance them with other earned revenue. Since they didn't earn enough of their own, we had to book $6.2 million to balance those at the end of the year. So, again, not just one thing. It will not happen again. We are actively monitoring this at the universities and also more closely at the system office. So just wanted you all to be aware of that. I'm not sure how this will work its way through the budget process. I have not yet seen OMB put anything forward on our behalf for this. So we just wanted to give the committee, you know, an opportunity to hear it from us first, I suppose. So any questions?
Director Kreckenberg, thank you for bringing that to our attention. As we look at the 26 budget, it is a little concerning that we've got this size of 24 ratification that wasn't a 24 supplemental last year. So we'll have some conversations after this subcommittee meeting about I appreciate your assurance that it won't happen again. We'll have some conversations about how the committee and the legislature can feel assured of that. But appreciate you surfacing this issue. Other questions or issues from committee members on the University of Alaska budget? We're a lively group this morning. Mr. Hutchison, anything else in your presentation?
No, Senator Keel, just we appreciate the committee giving us consideration.
Thank you. I'll ask all the members to please reach out to my office if you have follow-up questions, additional information, or to share your priorities and ideas. This is not a subcommittee that tends to have three or four meetings, so I'll look forward to each of you working with me and my team directly. I look forward to working with you and yours. That concludes our business for today. The Finance Committee, full Finance Committee, will meet again tomorrow morning, Wednesday, February 19th at 9 a.m., I understand the agenda will include the first hearing on Senate Bill 72, Railroad Corporation Financing, followed by a three-year budget outlook from the Legislative Finance Division. With nothing further to come before us, we are adjourned at 10:30 a.m.